Ben Franklin said, those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither. Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a playing card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I named it after myself, really. My website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there, more than 2,500 of them now, going back to 2003. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. Now we head over to sheldonfreeassociation.blogspot.com. Which I think if you just go to SheldonRichmond.com, it'll forward you on. Anyway, it's the blog of my good friend Sheldon Richmond, senior something or other at the Future of Freedom Foundation. How's it going?
It's going fine, and you're right. If you just put in SheldonRichmond.com, you'll get there.
Yeah, there you go. Well, why don't you just change the URL to SheldonRichmond.com?
Well, Blogspot, you know, gives you that.
Oh, I see.
But
yeah,
I created the domain, and that lets me make it an alias or something like that. I don't understand.
So. I get it. Well, hey, at least you own the URL to your own name.com. I don't. Some other guy's got it. And he will never sell it. I talked to him about it.
But it's not the real Scott Horton, I take it.
He's a newspaper man from Oklahoma, and he's owned scotthorton.com since 1995 when it first went on sale. So.
Okay.
Yeah, and he ain't giving it up. So I got .org, even though I'm not really an org very much. I'm more of an individual.
Yeah.
I'm a... Actually, that's not true. I am a legal fiction. I'm an LLC. Does that make me an org? You want to be on my board of directors?
Why wouldn't I make you a com? I don't know.
I don't know. I wonder if I could get .net somehow. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm wasting your time. Sheldon, I want to ask you about what the hell is going on in Israeli politics. And I know you know a lot about Israeli politics. And, you know, of course, the role Israeli politics plays in American politics. Tell me about Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party's merger with his foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beitenu party, which I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. It means Israel, our home. I'm not sure why they don't just translate it. But anyway, what does this mean? Is this a big deal, these two parties merging together? I mean, they're already in a coalition, right?
Yeah, that's true. Avigdor is the foreign minister. And they're saying it's not an outright merger. It's a merger of the lists for the next election, but not a merger of the two parties. Not sure exactly what that distinction means, but they are saying that. Mm-hmm. Avigdor, of course, is known as being rather a hardliner on the Palestinians and the Arabs in general. He's got quite a colorful history. He at one time, a few years ago, was recommending that Arabs and Israeli Jews be completely separated, including the Arabs who have been living in Israel continuously since, you know, before 1948 and right through. Then he backed off of that. So, you know, it's hard to know where he stands at any given moment, but he's hardly one of the people you think of when you think about possible reconciliation and people sitting down and talking about cooperation and putting all this violent nonsense behind them. So, it's hard to say. One bit of speculation is that Netanyahu did this so he'll look like a moderate by comparison.
Yeah.
But except he's now joined with him. I mean, they used to be able to say, well, look, he's not a Lieberman, but now he's teamed up with Lieberman, so maybe it cuts the other way that people won't be able to say he looks like a moderate by comparison anymore since since they've teamed up. There's also speculation that this will embolden the parties that are more pro-peace, you know, the centrist and left parties, because they'll try to rise to the occasion now that you have this coalition.
But who's left to rise for peace when the Labor Party is run by Ehud Barak, the defense minister?
Well, there's is Kadima still exist? You know, the former Likud partner that didn't last very long. They're sort of kind of a centrist party that, again, by comparison, would look better than Likud.
Yeah, they split up. That was Sharon's party. He split off from Likud when they had a disagreement over the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza.
Right.
The moving of the settlers out of Gaza and the turning of it into a giant prison.
Well, that's true. And which reminds me, one way to judge Lieberman is that Sharon, he was too much for Sharon. Sharon fired him from the cabinet. So that gives you a sense of how far out Lieberman is if Sharon couldn't tolerate him.
So now I'm trying to remember. It was Daniel Levy, Levy. He had written this thing back in, 2009, called The Israel of the Three Likuds. And it was about Kadima, Labor, and Likud, and how they're basically all Likud now. The Labor Party has really moved that far to the right under the leadership of Ehud Barak. And he wasn't even bringing up at that point this Israel Our Home Party. But they're like really hardcore secular right-wing nationalist types. And
right.
So now it's Israel of the Four Likuds, I guess. And then, so is there anyone else? Or is Kadima, do you think that there's much hope that Kadima could actually, you know, fill that role of the more moderate, peace-oriented party? I mean, Sharon's still in his coma, thank God.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't know whether Kadima's in any shape whatsoever to do anything. Haaretz was saying at the time that the story broke about the merging of the lists.
That's the liberal daily in Tel Aviv there, Haaretz.
Yes, and there was a column by Ari Shavit who was saying that, well, I can read a line from his. He says, this deck shuffling maneuver will repel both moderate voters and Mizrahim, which is the Jews of Middle East origins. So they may be completely grossed out by this and join forces in opposition. So it could give new life to, what are regarded as sort of centrist parties, which I suppose aren't as bad on the Palestinian question. Nobody seems to know. There's all this kind of speculation. This merger gets a pretty bad review from Shavit. He talks about how people will say, well, at least this group will be able to govern. But as he puts it, it'll be governability of the jackboot kind. So he's not looking forward to this.
Well, I wonder if power has moderated this guy, Avigdor Lieberman, because, of course, before he was foreign minister, he would say things like, maybe if Mubarak, who, of course, was his most loyal slave, right? If Mubarak doesn't like it, maybe we should just bomb the Aswan Dam, meaning flood Cairo.
And he had to apologize, over that sort of stuff. I guess he was forced into apologizing. It's just not the sort of stuff you're supposed to say in
diplomacy. That's pretty hardcore, though. And, Martin Peretz, who I would characterize as a neo-fascist, characterized this guy as a neo-fascist.
Yeah.
And that's pretty bad when neo-fascists call you a neo-fascist, then you're, like, pretty bad on some issues, right?
Right. When you, like I said, when you're too much for Sharon and Peretz and some others, you're really accomplishing something. That's really saying something. And now this reflects, of course, on Netanyahu for taking him in as a partner, especially when your last partner was Kadima, who I guess is a bit more reasonable than those guys on the right. So it's, I would say it bodes ill, but on the other hand, did we ever expect anything serious out of Netanyahu regarding the Palestinians? I would say no. We know that his interest is only in stalling. Meanwhile, they're still demolishing houses in the Middle East. They're still gobbling up territory. They're still building the wall. They're still building or expanding settlements. Netanyahu is not going to give any ground on this. And so I don't know what anybody's waiting for. I mean, you know, I'm more and more beginning to buy the theory that this whole Iran thing was just a way to take our minds off the West Bank and Gaza and the Palestinians.
Yeah, I've been thinking
and maybe
that
the whole thing was
too.
A bluff all along, or just a smokescreen, or a fire you light over there, so that no one's looking at the other place where the real damage is going on.
Yeah. Well, still, all blame lands on Barack Obama for that. You know, if he can have his administration put it in the New York Times last March that everybody knows Iran is not even making nukes, shut up Netanyahu, then he could have done it two marches before that too. And instead, he went along playing along with this, with his phony 2009 December 31st deadline before all the new sanctions, and with his phony outing of the comm facility, and with his all the rest of it. He's gone along with Netanyahu on making Iran the issue. If he wanted to say, "Oh, please, Iran's not even an issue," whatever, and the way he did this year, he could have put it on the back burner and stayed focused on the West Bank. And so, you know, Netanyahu, he might be, better at playing chess than Obama or whatever, but Obama's the one with all the power, and he just did nothing but lay down and get walked all over, so screw him. I mean, not that you were defending him or anything, but I'm just saying
that's where
the responsibility really lies. He came into power saying he wanted to do something about the West Bank.
Look, the Palestinians are, out of sight and out of mind. Was the word Palestine or Palestinians even spoken during the foreign policy debate? Of course, Israel was said many, many times by the two candidates.
I don't believe
But
I don't think they talked about Schieffer, the settlements or any of that at all.
Schieffer didn't bring it up. Nobody brings it up. But Iran is the big conversation. I mean, when Netanyahu was in New York for the UN meeting and he was getting on Andrea Mitchell and these other shows, all they talked about was Iran. It's a perfect way to take it's called misdirection in the art of stage magic. It's called misdirection, right? You don't want people look over on one side of the stage, so you create some diversion on the other side, and that's exactly what Netanyahu has done. And I'm beginning to believe the whole thing was a way to misdirect us, the whole world, from the Palestinians. And look at this, look how petty they can get when the leader of the Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, wants to go to the UN and try to upgrade their status. I mean, not even ask for full membership, which he first did, but then that got nowhere because the U.S. obstructed it. But even when he just says, "Well, okay, how about if can we have our status upgraded?" The U.S. Starts talking about how we're going to cut money off to them. Now, that I, like you, are opposed to foreign aid, just as on general principle, because it's money extracted from the taxpayers. But that issue aside, when the government responds to something like the Palestinians talking about upgraded status at the UN by saying, "Oh, we're going to just withhold your money," that just shows you how petty tyranny can get. Mm-hmm. I mean, it gets down to that level. I mean, what is so horrible about the request that we have to, hit them over the head with this? It just shows you how disgustingly petty tyranny can be. It doesn't even have grandeur. It's just petty.
Well, I ain't trying to encourage it or anything, but for the life of me, after years and years of looking at this, I still can't figure out why the Israeli government doesn't just round up every last Palestinian, Muslim, and Christian in the West Bank and force march them either into the river or across it. What are they waiting for? Who's going to stop them? Nobody. So why the slow motion ethnic cleansing of the West Bank? Just steal it then, you damn thieves. I don't understand.
Well, there's still a sense, I'm sure, that in the world and in the U.S. and even among some Israelis, that's just, that's too far. That's just a step too far. And I mean, I'm speculating, obviously, but I guess there's just a sense that that would be considered so out of bounds that they can't predict what the backlash would be in the U.S. And like I said, even a lot of Israelis, Jewish Israelis, would be repulsed by that. So I have to assume that's what's holding them back, even though it's pretty reasonable to think that that's what they would like to do. I assume they believe that would solve a lot of problems. I mean, they're you know, the Likud type position has always been that Jordan is the true Palestinian state, so everybody ought to just be thrown across the river and, you know, into Jordan. After all, they're showing no signs of wanting to give up the Jordan Valley, right?
Right.
There are Jews who have been moved into that, subsidized, and whenever they talk about what a final settlement might look like, they say, we want the Jordan Valley. Yeah, well, you know, we'll give the Palestinians some other land, but we want the Jordan Valley.
In other words, we'll have them surrounded no matter what.
Well,
and the facts on the ground, as they've made them, that's what they call it, the facts on the ground, are already such that it's too late for there to ever be an independent Palestine in the West Bank anyway, right? I mean, you would have to have really a war between the IDF and the settlers that they put there in order to get them out.
Well, more and more people are saying what you just said, including some Israelis, that a two-state solution is now impossible. Given what the what Israel has done, it's built so much into the West Bank, it's gobbled up so much of it. It's got this wall sneaking through, which surrounds some towns and separates residences from farmland, you know, olive groves. It's destroyed olive groves, and that now, you know, it's one state. The only question is it going to be an apartheid type state, or is it going to be a truly democratic state? It doesn't look like it's heading toward a truly liberal sort of democratic state where everybody has really equal rights. I mean, even the Arabs of Israel, the ones who have citizenship papers, are not treated as full citizens. In fact, they're more like third class. The reason I don't say they're second class is because the Ashkenazi Jews who dominate Israel have long treated the Sephardi Jews, which are the ones that, you know, come from Spain and then our Arab countries, always treated them as second class citizens. So the Arabs get, you know, are down to the third class. They don't get the same sort of public services, you know, the quality of services, you know, and stuff like that. So they're beginning to awaken, and there are people talking about saying, look, there are Arab citizens of Israel who have been here, you know, since the founding of Israel. Actually, you know, obviously they were there long before that, but they were there. They didn't flee when the 750,000 fled. They stayed behind. And so they've been there continuously, and even though they can have parties and they have some small, they're 20% of the population, they have some small representation in the parliament, but they can't really change the basic law. And some people are saying, well, maybe we ought to make some changes, like let's have the flag represent the fact that there are, you know, two groups here, Jews and Arabs. Arabs are both Muslim and Christian, of course, but the flag is a Jewish star, and the national anthem is a reference to Judaism, Jewishness. So some people are actually saying, let's change the flag of the national anthem to reflect the fact that 20% of this population are not Jews and that they're not going anywhere. So people are actually beginning to talk like that.
Well, and that gets us back to this Avigdor Lieberman character, because he's one of his proposals anyway was, how about we take all, I guess it's, there are certain villages inside Israel where the Arab Israelis live, you know, mostly concentrated together kind of thing, rather than spread out. And so how about we'll redraw the border and they won't even be Israelis anymore. We'll strip them of their citizenship and they will be Palestinians included within the West Bank. And then we'll redraw the borders in the West Bank so that we'll just call that Israel, where the Israeli settlements already are. We'll just go ahead and you know, stop calling them settlements and call them one territory.
Well, he made that proposal not that long ago. He has since given it up, and, you know, who knows if he just gave it up for political purposes. Maybe his felt his ambition was being thwarted if he stuck to that. So we can't really tell, but he doesn't claim that position today. But we know there's an awful lot of animosity. We see how Israeli youth attack Arabs. There's, you know, death to Arabs, kill the Arabs. There's a definite deep-seated hostility to Arabs. Now, you know, they may say, well, that's because Arabs hurt us, but I always have to raise the context. I mean, it's something you've long pointed out. Who's occupying whom?
Yeah, well, you know,
people want to forget that and just say, well, look, Arabs commit violence, and I don't justify that, but the point is they are the ones who were imposed upon by the UN in 1947 when they partitioned Palestine. They were never asked their opinion of anything, and I mean the Palestinians, the Arabs living in Palestine. I'm not talking about the rest of the Arab world. Preferences and desires were never even taken into account. They were never even asked.
Yeah, they lied and pretended nobody lived there. Yeah, it's a land without people for a people without land. How convenient, huh?
Well, that's right. And people even knew in the late 1890s when Herzl and his people were saying that, their own folks went over to visit Palestine to check it out, and they came back and said to Herzl, hey, guess what? It's not a land without a people. So they knew that, and everybody knew it. The UN knew it, but the British knew it during World War I. But the point is, when the idea of partition started to get floated, nobody sat down with the Palestinians and said, "What do you think of this?" They didn't matter, and we're living with the headaches of British imperialism. You know, where they made contradictory promises to everybody. You know, they promised the Arabs independence, but they also promised the Turks if the Turks would not side with the Germans, and then they promised, then they promised the Zionist organizations under the Balfour Declaration. So they made all these promises, and Balfour later himself said, it's in his diaries or memoirs or something, he said, look, we knew full well we were making promises that conflicted and that we had never had any intention of keeping.
Right.
So, of course, we're living with all these troubles now. That's what comes of imperialist duplicity. It was totally cynical on the part of the British, and the French were involved in this too. But Palestine was an area that was supposed to be under, you know, British domination, and then the U.S. just picked up where the British left off, and Truman recognized Israel immediately. And the reason he did, even though he had lots of people in the State Department telling him this is crazy, he said, "Look, how many Arab votes do I have to worry about?" I mean, it was purely political. It had nothing to do with principle or self-determination or anything like that, and the Palestinians got screwed, and they've been screwed ever since.
Well, now in East Jerusalem, which under the UN mandate was supposed to be, I don't know what is the deal with East Jerusalem.
Under the UN mandate, Jerusalem was supposed to be an independent, universal city, not binational city. You know, there's a term they use for it, which I can't recall at the moment, like a French term or a Latin term or something. So it wasn't supposed to be divided. It got divided in the war, where Israel had secret negotiations with the Jordanians to make sure there was no Palestinian state, to make sure the part of the partition didn't come to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did. They divided it up. And Golda Meir negotiated secretly with a representative of King Abdullah, who was King Hussein's grandfather, and that's what they did. They said neither side wanted there to be the Palestinian part of the partition. And I have a feeling that Ben Gurion, you know, the first prime minister, and the other founders of the state were thinking, okay, let Jordan have the Palestinian part right now. We'll get it in due course. Just bide our time, be patient, and something will happen. And of course, 1967 happened. And they took it, and they've had it ever since.
I can't ever remember the name of it, but I'm sure you remember a few years back, there was leaked the PDF file from a Frank Luntz study, which he's that big fat Republican pollster guy, and they did this study about, you know, how to basically manipulate American opinions about the West Bank and about the occupation over there. And, of course, a big part of it was to spin it like, the Palestinians of the West Bank, they are brown supremacists, and they have this Jim Crow system where they won't let the poor Jews just live wherever they want.
Yeah,
they're
right.
Such bigots, and just turn the whole thing upside down. But then another part of his advice was, and apparently, you know, some Israel lobbyists in America had made the mistake of using this very bad talking point, and so he was correcting them and saying, don't accuse the Palestinians of being in violation of their zoning laws as your excuse to bulldoze their houses and steal all their land because Americans hate zoning. But that had been their big PR thing that they thought would be their good justification before that was your house that was built in 1902 is not up to the code, you know?
Well, Israel supporters have been, you know, very good at presenting their case to the American people. It was tailored for the American people. The Palestinians, unfortunately, have not been as good. And the media has tended to help the Israeli side. I mean, there are Israeli representatives on television all the time. Their English is always impeccable. Heck, their U.N. ambassador, no, the U.S. ambassador, Oren, you wouldn't know he's an Israeli. Doesn't even have any kind of accent. So they can put him on, and people can listen to him, and they say, oh, well, look, that guy seems reasonable. He seems like one of us. How often do you even see a Palestinian on? Not much. They have some very eloquent spokespeople. Hannah Nashrari, for one thing, is an extremely intelligent woman, very articulate. Her English is very good. She does have a trace of an accent. But how often is she on TV? Why isn't she on television being interviewed by Andrea Mitchell and all these people? Right. It's just like with Iran. I mean, how often do you see an Iranian on television? Why don't they want us to see these people? Well, I think you and I know the answer. It would hurt their case if we saw reasonable people coming on and talking about the hardship and you know, all the other issues involved in this thing. And it's better to keep them off TV so they're more easily portrayed as, you know, terrorists and recalcitrant and people who don't want to cooperate. And, you know, who would know that in 1988 Yasser Arafat said, look, okay, we relinquish all claim to 78% of Palestine, which means, you know, Israel, as it was set up under the partition. Just give us our 22%, which is the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. You know, do you think the average American knows that that happened in 1988? Of course not. And that other Arab countries signed on to that and agreed to recognize Israel? No, you wouldn't know that. You would think they all just ready to pounce.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course, you'd think, you know, the Palestinians were the aggressors. Land for peace is, it makes it sound like, you know, the Israelis are on the ground with their arm being twisted behind their back, and if only they give up some of their land, will the Palestinians stop suicide bombing them to death all the time?
Right, right, right. Every time, you know, anything the Israelis say is considered generous. Oh, look how they're going the extra mile. And, you know, but it's Palestine. It's the Palestinians who are basically who are saying, look, we'll give up our claim even to the homes in Israel itself. We'll give up our claim to that. We'll no longer either want compensation or a right of return. And yet what credit do they don't get any credit for that. Most people don't know it, and they think that the Palestinians are just a bunch of terrorists. Look, even when rockets go from Gaza into Sderot and other villages in southern Israel, which I don't justify, but it does help to know the context. In 48, during the war, people were driven, or before the war, you know, people were driven out of that village and that area. Arabs were driven out. Palestinians were driven out and driven into Gaza. So some of the people that lob rockets are either refugees or children of refugees who know that that village was once an Arab village. But the Israelis destroyed 400 or so Arab villages, changed the names, paved them over, rebuilt them, and they're Jewish only. And
yeah, I can see my house from
here. When you hear about rockets going from Gaza to those villages.
Right. I mean, this is like the riot at Attica Prison. They're throwing Molotov cocktails over the wall. Something like that, you know?
Yeah. And again, you know, I don't like the idea of people firing rockets near schools and, you know, hitting children or possibly hitting children or residences. I don't mean to be saying that that's an okay tactic. But it does help to understand things, even if you don't approve of what people are doing. It's ridiculous to say, well, I don't need to understand it then. That's stupid. That's just totally stupid.
Hey, the fact that even the Israelis call them rockets and don't even dare to pretend that they amount to missiles is pretty telling, you know?
Well, and you know, look, they're hardly the latest technology. Israel, on the other hand, has, you know, the very latest of everything, since they get, what, $3 billion a year from the U.S. under very favorable terms, terms that no other country gets. In other words, they get it all in a lump sum on January 1st rather than have it paid out. and they don't they get to earn any interest on it. You know, normally with like with Egypt or another country, the government, the U.S. government pays it out over the year, these days, of course, the government's in the red, so it's not earning any interest on it. But it doesn't have to pay the money out sooner than, you know, it's agreed to. Israel gets it all on day one, and since it's not spending it all at once, it gets to earn the interest. This is all taxpayer, this is the American taxpayer's money.
Yep.
It shouldn't be taken from the taxpayers in the first place. And I don't just mean Israeli money shouldn't be. I mean money for any country, but we're talking about Israel right now. And, when we just signed this new cooperation agreement the U.S. government did with Israel, which means they're getting the latest stuff, and instead of addressing this issue of the Gazans and stolen land, what are we doing? We're helping them build a shield, right, against the rockets. But maybe they wouldn't have to defend themselves against rockets if they would sit down and talk to the Palestinians.
Right. Hey, I want to, I know you got to go, but I wanted to bring up one more thing here real quick. Mm-hmm. And that is that there was this piece here in the New York Times. I think, well, I don't know who wrote it. It's not the greatest thing or whatever, but it's worth a read. It's by Robert F. Worth. And, it's called Al-Qaeda Inspired Groups Minus Goal of Striking the U.S. And, it's basically about how, you know, what was unique about bin Laden and Zawahiri and their, you know, the merging of Azzam's group with the Islamic Jihad and their goals that they agreed upon was striking the U.S., which they blame for supporting all of their local enemies. And only once we bankrupt and drive the U.S. out of here will we be able to take on all our local dictatorships or whatever. Yeah. But the norm would be if you're a jihadist from Libya, you fight in Libya against Kami Gaddafi. Or if you're a jihadist in Jordan, you fight against the Hashemite king or whatever, right? So, anyway, I just wanted to point out that, first of all, that's what the article is, but they say here in the second to last paragraph, they admit, I think, as far as I'm aware, for the first time in the history of the New York Times, what it was the motivation for the September 11th attacks, or even, you know, more importantly, for the formation of Al-Qaeda and their purpose in attacking America, the far enemy, which made them so different than all the rest of these local revolutionaries. And what it says is, most of the political realities that inspire bin Laden's organization are still in place, including America's apparently unqualified support for Israel and the rulers of the Persian Gulf states. So, yeah. That's why we were attacked on September 11th. Support for what we've just been talking about for half an hour. Israel's perpetual unlimited warfare and crime against the people of Palestine. That just, it never ends and it's all paid for with American dollars. The bullets are NATO rounds fired from American M16s and M4 machine guns. The bombs fall from American F-16s and Apache helicopters and you'd have to be a real dumb Palestinian to not understand what's going on with that. And who's ultimately responsible for that?
I was just writing on this subject over the weekend, and all you have to do is Google the Al-Qaeda fatwa against the United States, and you read the two fatwas that came out in 96 and 98, and bin Laden goes through the reason. And you just mentioned one. They also mentioned having U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, near the holy places. The funny thing is, even Wolfowitz admitted that that was something that led to terrorism against the United States, because when we were building up for the war in Iraq, one of the benefits, he said, of going into Iraq was we could take the troops out of Saudi Arabia, move them to Iraq, because the troops in Saudi Arabia have been such, irritate people so much in the Middle East. I mean, he was conceded the point.
Right.
And then the third thing, of course, was the more than decade long sanctions on Iraq after the Gulf War, which didn't come off until the U.S. then invaded Iraq. Bin Laden is quite clear in the two fatwas precisely what the reasons are. And then every time a member of Al Qaeda has been brought before an American court, like for sentencing or something, like the guys involved in the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, every time they get a chance to make a statement, they say the same thing. They never say we hate America for your freedom or MTV or you got too much nudity here or, you know, they say you're trashing our part of the world. Cut it out.
You know, in the book Perfect Soldiers by Terry McDermott, the L.A. Times reporter, it's a biography mostly of the Hamburg cell, the ringleaders of the 9/11 plot, the pilots. And it's about, part of what he talks about there is how Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib and Marwan al-Shehhi, these were the guys from, you know, Hamburg Mosque, and they would hang out in their apartment all day. And this is before they ever went to Afghanistan and, you know, met with bin Laden and them, which there's video of that. They would just sit around and talk about what was going on in Palestine and in Lebanon at the time, and how Americans have to pay for this. That was their thing. The guys that became the actual pilots of those hijacked jets. That was their thing before they ever even got recruited by bin Laden.
The Hamburg cell, that's right. I guess that's why George Bush bombed Hamburg after 9/11. Oh, wait a second. We didn't bomb Hamburg, did we? No, we didn't do that, even though a lot of the work went on at Hamburg.
It's like Carlin says, we don't ever bomb white people. Well, okay, except that time against the Germans, but that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. As long as they're going along with our program, we would never bomb them. Only brown people.
Well, that's right. No, it is true. And of course, we had people like Madeleine Albright saying, you know, 500,000 Iraqi children's children dying is worth it to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And you know that was played over and over again in the Middle East. And, you know, if you set out to get a group of people mad or a part of the world mad at you, to the point where they would want to do you harm, you couldn't do a better job than the U.S. government has done since 1948. Maybe we can go back even further, but certainly from 48 on. You couldn't construct a better strategy for having that result, making a whole group of people so pissed at you that they're willing to, they could find volunteers to fly planes into buildings, into tall buildings.
Yeah, well, then again, this is a common theme all show long. It works out real well if you're a stockholder in Raytheon. But for the rest of us, not so much.
Well, that's right. That's why we don't want to say it's madness, and we don't want to say it's irrational. Because from the point of view of people who are profiting and the people that are, you know, amassing power, even if it's not money, but politicians getting power, it's not insane or irrational. It's in a sense, perfectly rational. They wanted an end, and they found a darn good means to achieve the end, money and power. So how can you argue with that? But you're right. The rest of us suffer.
Right. Yeah, I shouldn't leave out all the generals and their ribbons. I mean, just imagine, everyone, use your imaginations, how many ribbons have been attached to officers' shirts in the last decade? Yeah. Like tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of additional ribbons have been granted. And that is really important. You know, people should not underestimate how much a military man loves playing dress up.
And that would make the ribbon makers big profiteers. So
I know. I wonder if there's a big, like, plastic metal lobby in D.C. We got to keep the war going.
Yeah, there's a ribbon cartel. I think we need to have Nick Kirsch looking on this.
Yeah, exactly. It's the public choice theory of American empire. All right.
Well, we'll find out that, you know, Dick Cheney actually is the ribbon magnet.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I'm glad you said his name, because he one time admitted that it was hatred of American support for Israel that was responsible for the Islamist insurgency being directed against the United States.
And didn't Petraeus get in trouble for it?
I'm sorry?
Petraeus said something like that before Congress and got in trouble for it, didn't he? Or he didn't say it in his oral remarks, but they were in the written remarks. Remember that? There was something along those lines where he said, I know this is a sensitive issue, but our support for Israel is what creates a lot of trouble for us.
Right. And you know what? People want a real hoot on those lines. Go to the Mondo Weiss blog and search about Petraeus, and you will find where this activist, James Morris, had been pestering David Petraeus by email, and Petraeus responded back to him, but accidentally had attached his email conversation with Max Boot that basically had Petraeus on his knees kissing Boot's boots and saying, please, please don't dislike me now. What if I tell you that I had dinner with Eli Wiesel last night? Will you tell all the Jews not to hate me, please? I mean, it's right in there.
I remember it well. I read it back then. You're right. It got some attention. It's pretty pathetic. And, of course, he got rewarded by they gave him the CIA, right? So
yeah,
he's doing fine.
It's really too bad that that David Hackworth died of Agent Blue disease, bladder cancer, from the U.S. government's chemical warfare against their own men during Vietnam. Because, man, I would love to hear what he would have to say about David Petraeus, you know?
No, I agree. I can recall TV appearances by Hackworth. What would that be, around the time of the Gulf War? And the second one, too. He was always great, yeah. There was like almost nobody like him. The only guy who I think even equaled him was Edward Peck.
Right.
The former ambassador to one of the countries over there, who got totally frozen out of television, right? He used to be on TV, used to see him around the time of the Gulf War, and I think even leading up to the Iraq War. And then I think, you know, the higher-ups must have said, hey, we can't put this guy on. He's a critic of the American empire, and unfortunately his credentials are too good, right? He was a former State Department guy. We got to get this guy off TV. And I haven't seen him in years.
Well, he's at the Council for the National Interest now, but you're right. I should interview him all the time. I've interviewed him a couple of times.
Wasn't he on the Mari, what was that, that ship, that boat that, on the flotilla? The Mari, whatever it was called.
Mavi Mari
or something. Mm-hmm. I think he was on that, and he's not a young guy. He's heroic.
I didn't remember that, but very well could be.
Because he was one of the few voices of sanity that got on the TV now and then.
Yeah, well, we can't have sanity. But yeah, I just remember Hackworth just crucifying Wesley Clark, calling him the perfumed prince, the politician. You know, that any real man in the military would think Wesley Clark was a little sissy. That kind of talk where you gotta be, and you have to be covered in ribbons and medals yourself to be able to talk like that credibly about a powerful general. But so that's why I miss Hackworth so much, because I think he would have just absolutely slayed Petraeus by now. I mean, Petraeus probably would have had to follow John Nagle and go become the head of a boys' school somewhere in disgrace.
Yeah, I agree. There weren't too many like Hackworth. In fact, you can count them on.
All right. I'm abusing my privileges here. I've kept you way over time, Sheldon. Thank you so much for your time on the show.
My pleasure. And anytime, Scott.
All right, everybody. That is the great Sheldon Richman from the Future of Freedom Foundation. That's FFF.org, of course, and SheldonRichman.com for his website. Here's that clip of Madeleine Albright, in case you didn't hear it, from 1997 or 8, maybe.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
So, yeah, you could see why that would anger people. And by the way, you can find Bin Laden's fatwas at the PBS NewsHour website. Government TV there. They copied and pasted the whole thing for you. It's called The Declaration of War Against the Americans Occupying the Land of the Two Holy Places. Hey, folks. Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny and Lane at DagnyandLane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount.